everyone, and welcome to episode 19 of the Yogic Studies podcast. I'm Seth Powell, and in today's episode, we are joined by Theodora Wildcroft, who's the author of a new book entitled Post-Lineage Yoga, From Guru to Hashtag Me Too. I really enjoyed this conversation with Theo, which touches on a truly wide range of topics pertaining to her research on British yoga subcultures and festivals. We talk about the balance between tradition versus innovation, the guru-shishya model and relationship, and how that might be changing today. Theo talks a lot about peer-to-peer networks of the exchange and transmission of knowledge between teachers rather than simply from teacher to student. We talk about pre-modern versus modern yoga, the nuances of the scholar-practitioner, and of course, we dive deep into an exploration of what Theo has termed post-lineage yoga, and we get into what that does and does not mean. Dr. Theodora Wildcroft is a teacher, trainer, writer, and scholar, and the author of the new book, Post-Lineage Yoga, From Guru to Hashtag Me Too, published by Equinox in 2020. Her research considers the democratization of yoga post-lineage and the many different ways yoga communities are responding to concerns about safety in practice. She's at the forefront of the movement for trauma sensitivity, diversity, and inclusion. In 2019, she completed her PhD with the Open University in Religious Studies with the thesis titled Patterns of Authority and Practice Relationships in Post-Lineage Yoga. This thesis, of course, would become the book that we discuss today. An accomplished writer with two decades of experience in group facilitation, she not only delivers compelling lectures and inspiring writing, but holds careful and thoughtful spaces for groups and individuals to deepen their knowledge, share experiences, and acquire new skills. Again, something we talk a bit about at the end of this episode. All right, without further ado, hope you enjoy this wide-ranging conversation with Dr. Theodora Wildcroft. All right. I am here today joined by Theo Wildcroft. Theo, welcome to the Yogic Studies podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here. And tell us where you're tuning in from today.
Thank you. I'm here in Wiltshire in the UK. It's evening here. I think it's afternoon where you are. Thank you for having me. It's lovely to have the conversation.
Yeah, just afternoon here in California, and I'm sitting here having a cup of tea, and I'm holding your new book, Post-Lineage Yoga, From Guru to Hashtag Me Too. You don't see many of these books with a hashtag in the title. So you know you're holding something really fresh and new, you know, something of this current moment.
Well, there was a debate about that, actually, as to whether it would get lost in certain kinds of indexes.
Oh, yeah.
But the conclusion was if it was in the subtitle, we'd probably get away with it. It's okay, so long as the title didn't have a hashtag in it.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about that. Certain digital landscapes, if it recognizes it as a hashtag, it can kind of do funny things to it where it embeds it as a link or something, right?
Yeah,
interesting. But you decided to go for it.
We did, yeah. I think because of that, I think the Me Too movement has been such a kind of important thing within yoga culture in the last few years that we really wanted that sense of the span of time that we're really talking about, the real difference between kind of pre-modern yoga and contemporary yoga and kind of how we've got to where we've got to, I think.
Yeah, and I want to get to that hashtag Me Too side of the subtitle a bit later in the conversation, I think. But to kick us off, well, first of all, you know, we've had some nice exchanges over the last month or so, partly through the SOAS Center for Yoga Studies, which you kindly invited me to participate in that recent panel on accessibility and disability. I think that went pretty well.
Oh, yeah, no, that went really well. I was very happy with it. And just purely in terms of numbers, it was one of the most successful kind of events we've had, I think, and the numbers of people tuning in. And again, I think that the point for me was, how do you not just look at pre-modern evidence, but how do you make it relevant? How do you ask the questions that are relevant to contemporary audiences? And how do you kind of manage that translation and interpretation across time? And so thank you so much for helping with that, because I think it worked really well. You and Melanie Klein kind of really met.
Yeah. Well, it was funny. It was funny, right? Theo. I don't know if I just missed the memo, but I thought you were going to be giving the part two. And I was sort of I was surprised or thrown off when that wasn't the case. I think it's because
Melanie dropped in. Melanie was fairly last minute. It was one of those kind of heroic things that scholars sometimes do, where with kind of 2 weeks notice or something, she said, yeah, I can do this. And what do you need me to say? And I said, these are the points I want you to cover, and so on. Yeah. Just because it's really hard for me to host and be part of the events at the same time. So it was just too many hats to be wearing, too many roles to be playing. So she did heroic work just to step up last minute and make it happen, I think.
Absolutely. But I wanted to say, I was really looking forward to hearing your side of that. Mm. And maybe we can get into that a little bit more today, because it's very relevant to the other things that we'll be talking about. But it's kind of thinking about, you know, where the historical meets the modern, thinking about... even these categories of pre-modern versus modern, and how well those might serve us or not, and all kinds of things there. So we've started to come to know each other a little bit. I think we have, you know, so many colleagues and friends, you know, in this world of yoga studies. I feel like maybe we briefly met or crossed paths in Krakow at that international yoga conference.
Oh, yes. So I'm going to do something slightly naughty in advance. Do you want a little heads up? Your listeners want a sneak preview.
Yeah.
Is I've been talking to Matilda, who organized the first Krakow conference, and we're going to do it again. Mm. And we're going to do it in collaboration between SOAS and Jagiellonian in Krakow. We literally haven't announced this yet. So,
wow, that's very
slightly
exciting.
Naughty of me.
Because that, honestly, looking back, there's been so many amazing conferences, but that one really stands out. That was very special.
I don't know if you're not kind of an active academic in yoga studies, I don't know if people really understand how scattered this field is, and yet how close it is in many ways. You know, when most of us do know each other, and we're all kind of all across the world, but there's not huge budgets in this work, so the chances that we have to all come together and to share are quite very rare and very special, I think. And I remember Mark, I was going to say bouncing up to Mark Singleton, but Mark Singleton actually bounced up to me. Mm. I remember and said, oh, I've been waiting. Like there were a lot of those moments of, oh, I've been really looking forward to meeting you and to have conversations together.
I think for me, you know, there's a lot of great academic conferences, and they're important for the field for a number of reasons. So I'm trained in religious studies, right? So the big one is the American Academy of Religion and the AAR. Sure. Yeah. There's AAS and there's AOS and all kinds of different. But within those kind of, you know, religious studies or Asian studies conferences, there might be one panel on yoga or two panels on yoga.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So to get to have like a full weekend dedicated to yoga in all of its aspects that it's being engaged with and studied is just like an intellectual feast, you know, for us.
It
so it's incredible. So that's exciting. I'm thrilled to hear that. And I just hope it's going to be in person. I hope that that's not going to be a virtual conference.
All I will tell you, it's going to be May 2022. So fingers crossed.
Right. In Krakow.
yeah. Yeah. We decided it's actually much more accessible to do it there, because I mean, London's just really expensive. Mm. I mean, it's expensive for me. never mind anyone else.
Right.
So,
right.
So yeah, I think doing it in Krakow makes it much more accessible for that wider range of scholars from across Europe and from South Asia and South America and lots of other places. Where scholars don't always have the opportunity to travel to international conferences. So that, I think, also kind of broadens the excitement for me of what's on offer. I haven't made it to AAR, even though my discipline is also religious studies, because I literally haven't been able to afford it, when I was kind of funded as a PhD student.
Yeah.
So
that's a huge challenge. So, it's a huge challenge as a graduate student to attend.
Yeah, yeah.
These things that you're supposedly required to attend to make a career, but then they just expect you to be able to, you know, put it on a credit card or something. Sometimes you can get funding, but if it's international, it can be really challenging.
Yeah. 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 So I think that for me, that was as much as anything else, what was really special about the Krakow conference was, listening to, Russian scholars and Finnish scholars and so on, talking about the kind of different flavors and nuances of how modern yoga has evolved in different environments and different countries. And I think that otherwise we tend to assume that kind of that big transnational Anglophone yoga is everything that modern yoga is, and of course it isn't. It's different from place to place. It's different in Japan than it is in, Korea. It's different in all these different places. So that localization really excites me, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember that being a unique feature of that conference, that there were so many case studies from, I think, Turkey and Japan and really important work, because it's so easy for North America and Western Europe even to kind of be centered in a lot of this discourse, will be the center of what we talk about today. But it's always important to kind of highlight that there is some really other exciting work that is taking place in other countries, other languages. So let's get into your book, into your work, but by way of getting there, take us back a little bit. Tell us, some version of your story, and how did you get into not only the academic study of yoga, but yoga? Mm-hmm. How did you discover yoga? And then how did that lead to this eventual dissertation and now turned book?
Well, I think that my journey through yoga has been in some ways unusual, in some ways typical. And by typical, I mean that I started out as a casual practitioner for many years. I would pop along to the occasional yoga class, the same way as I might to kind of any other kind of movement class. I'd started doing that back at university. So it was a long, fairly long period of time of casual kind of engagement in yoga.
And you grew up in England?
I grew up in England, yeah. So, it was, like I said, I think the first time I went to a yoga class was probably at university, and then the first time. So it was quite a long time before I realized how, in a weird way, how important it was to me. There was a moment when I realized that the consistent thing that I'd been coming back to year in, year out had been different forms of yoga class, and that was an interesting thing to kind of realize. And I think it was that spurred, in many ways, my desire to really figure out what it was that was special about a yoga practice for me. And it's probably worth saying that I as a young woman in particular, I was quite dissociative. So physically dissociative, I don't have much awareness of my body. So although I'd always been involved in kind of dance, martial arts and various other things, there was something about the rigor of fairly strong alignment-based practice that really put me back into like a, it kind of held me in a framework that was really useful and really important for me at a particular time in my life. And it was interesting that that happened to be because I was living in a, you know, I'm living in a small town in rural Wiltshire. And that happened to be an Anusara studio, which is really wild because, you know, at that time, Anusara yoga was all over the States. But, you know, we were one of something like 3 Anusara studios in the country, in the UK. So it was actually quite unusual here. And it just happened to be my, you know, the local studio. And so I happened to do my teacher training in that style because it was the one that was around, basically.
A lot of my good yoga friends were in that community. So I know it somewhat well.
Yeah. And of course, being in that community was a really interesting thing because I was kind of a student of Anusara and then taught Anusara for a couple of years. I think it was about 5 years into that journey when my body started to get really tired. I'm quite hypermobile, or I'm not as bad as I used to be, but I'm quite hypermobile. And I think that Anusara and these kind of alignment based traditions, they emphasize holding yourself together while at the same time getting into end of range motion, which can be really safe in the short term, but gets really exhausting because you're just working so hard to keep yourself safe while still throwing yourself into kind of scorpion poses and so on. And I was kind of, you know, I was interested in kind of wider aspects of the practice and the kind of moments of transcendence that you could find within a physical movement practice, which were interesting. You know, the idea that movement itself could be sacred was kind of aligned with some of my experiences elsewhere in life with other movement disciplines. But it was at that point that the kind of scandal started to emerge around John Friend. And we started to really ask ourselves, I think, some hard questions about what we'd been sold and what we were selling, shall we say.
Any personal relation or connection to John, or was it kind of through a few? Oh, you did, yeah.
Well, it's a wild thing. Okay, so as a teacher of Anusara, even kind of out here in Europe, it was expected that you would study with him, which meant that he would, you know, he would be do these big tours, and every year they would announce the tour, and he'd be, you know, he'd have 2 or 3 dates in Europe or whatever, and you'd have to go, okay, well, can I get to Switzerland in July? You know, how am I going to do that? That adds up, you know, like the money alone adds up. Certainly, I think most of us spent more on things like that than we ever really earned in our little part-time yoga teaching. But also, I had a background by that point. You know, it's probably, I'm going to flip and talk a little bit about my academic background.
Sure.
So I'm kind of a working class kid who got into Cambridge here in the UK, which was kind of a weird and wild experience. And kind of, I think like a lot of working class kids, kind of found myself slightly spat out at the end of that with this Cambridge degree. And yet none of the connections that will, and networking that allows you to I don't know, get kind of high paying jobs or anything. So I actually, that degree was in languages. So I kind of left for France and spent some time in France and kind of moved around and did various different things. And I'd been doing a certain amount of youth work, and it was actually the youth service paid for me to do my master's degree. So this is this weird situation where my undergraduate degree is kind of MML, as it's known, Modern and Medieval Languages from Cambridge. And then my master's degree is youth and community work from De Montfort up in Leicester. It's like the two ends, in some ways, the two ends of the academic university spectrum. And De Montfort is a fine institution, and it was a fine MA, but it was very much based on pragmatic learning for people who needed to understand the power and politics involved in their job. You know, kind of, you know, our first module, I think, was on anti-oppressive practice in youth work, for example. So I'd spent, 3 years on this master's, looking at different forms of informal education, looking at kind of anti-oppressive work in various kinds, being taught by scholars from the Global South in many instances, and having real understanding of things like, reading things like Paulo Ferreira's Pedagogy of the Oppressed and bell hooks and mm-hmm. all of these kinds of things. So there's this moment. So, that was kind of, so 10 years after that, I find myself teaching yoga in ways that I suddenly realize completely contradict all of my understanding about how grassroots education really works. And it's all of these kind of very hierarchical systems. And I just not put these two things together. And when I did, that was kind of, it kind of ruined any of those big structures and big lineages for me in many ways. I'm always interested in kind of grassroots and peer networks and how they work and how knowledge is shared outside of those institutions.
Mm. I can see how that worked its way into what you call post-lineage yoga.
Well, this is the thing. So then at some point, I was actually at a festival and I was sat with a friend, and I think there were various forms of movement practice going on in this, at least, and we're not talking about festivals, we're talking about the kind of festivals that you find in my book, which are nothing like kind of Wanderlust or even Glastonbury or anything like that. You're talking about kind of 200, 300 kind of countercultural hippies in a field together hanging out, and nobody's getting paid to be there, and everyone does the washing up together and that kind of thing. So I'm at an event like that. I think it was actually a pagan event, and I'm talking to this friend of mine, and I'm just waving my arms around saying, why is nobody talking about this? Why is this such a hidden history?
And yoga was happening in those spaces?
Yoga was happening. Well, I was teaching some of it. So yeah, there was definitely yoga happening, okay. But also, kind of martial arts and sweats and, and there's this long history of different forms of movement practice being practiced in those environments, and the kind of links between that and a connection to something ill-defined that's about a connection to nature, that's about a connection to community, and kind of various other things that come together in those spaces. And it was such a hidden history. And the friend of mine that I was talking to said, look, either you write a book or you do a PhD, but you've got to do something because you can't keep having these conversations, waving your arms around. And then he uttered the killer line, which I now know is like the academic equivalent of a come on. The killer line was, Theo, I'm not saying that you would regret not doing a PhD. I'm saying academia will regret it if you don't do one. Which really is, it's an academic come on line if ever there was one. And that friend of mine was a professor of religious studies at the Open University here in the UK. And the Open University brings me full circle in academic terms in many ways, because the Open University is a very different institution again. It was set up for and still champions mature learning, modular learning, online learning, and was doing that, well before many other institutions were doing that in the world. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of quite proud that my PhD is from the Open University in many ways, although in practice it was a very traditional PhD journey, at least for the UK. Mm. But it's nice to be part of that institution as well. When PhD projects, dissertations, theses, whatever you want to talk about, that research project, however you want to label it, the heart of that process is, if your supervisors were anything like mine, the whole idea is make it small and make it rigorous.
Right.
So make the project as small as possible. Be realistic about what you can actively study here. So I actually only set out to describe this one community. We can talk more about how describing that community has turned into a way of understanding some major currents, not just, I think, within contemporary yoga, but actually within historical yoga as well in some ways. And it's an idea that was in some ways gifted to me by this odd journey that I'd been on, because it comes from the understandings that I gained in my master's studies, as much as it does my experience of kind of yoga environments in many ways.
So let's talk a little bit more about this community in particular that you're looking at in Britain. I want to read this quote from your preface. You write, "Yoga scholars in particular do a great disservice to contemporary practitioners when we fail to take account of the true diversity, history, intention, and experiences at the heart of contemporary yoga practice."
Yes.
This is something I've felt for a long time, as somebody who also comes, you know, first from a yoga teacher and practitioner background and then into academia. When one looks at modern yoga studies, let's say, broadly, I think there's some important exceptions to this, or even outside of that, even more so, right? If you just look at studies on new age religious movements or new religious movements, it's so easy, it's almost the low-hanging fruit to kind of make fun of the modern yoga practitioner, to not take it seriously on its own terms, to not see it as a valid expression of spirituality or religiosity or as something that can be studied in its own right and not simply as a derivative of something traditional, something original. So I think there's some important, there's a number of works that are starting to come out that are doing that. Like I had Amanda Lucia on the podcast recently with her book, White Utopias. And she also makes this point in her work, which is also ethnographic and working with people at festivals in particular. But the point is to take seriously these modern practitioners, these communities, their experiences, their expressions of practice on its own terms. So I wanted to just point that out. And if there's anything you want to say about that, but then segue into, let's talk about, you know, who these people are, what this community that, you know, you call it this subculture, and what is, like, how do we delimit or define the yoga that's going on in these spaces? So I guess there's a number of things in there.
So absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of my kind of academic sources, my kind of the foundations that I build on are within kind of recent scholarship within religious studies, which I'm sure you're aware of, which is around ideas of vernacular religion, lived religion, you know, what is it that people actually do? And I'm going to name no names on this because it would be mean to name names, but I read a book on modern yoga at one point in my studies, which said that contemporary practitioners are kind of mimicking or aping the practice of kind of authentic yoga by doing all of these rituals, and you know, occasionally they'll do pujas, they'll sing bhakti, and so on. And I just think that after decades of pretending that all modern yoga practitioners do is just essentially a form of gymnastics. You know, that modern practitioners can't win. I mean, if you're at the point where you're getting up for dawn havens and you're doing seva for your community, and you know, at what point does practicing become authentic? Right, particularly if this is something that is a significant and repeated part of your life. And that is really where I wanted to start. It's an unusual idea, but that maybe when we're talking about contemporary yoga, the people that can tell us the most about it aren't the people who just drop into a class once a week every so often and may as well be at Zumba, you know, or Pilates or whatever. Maybe the people who can teach us something about it are the people who are doing it, who are dedicating significant resources within their life, significant time within their life to it. And that seemed to be a very unusual idea, because they're not necessarily the mainstream. If you look at how many millions of people in the world practice a little bit of yoga here and there, or, you know, maybe do a little bit on the We Fit or whatever, there are a lot of people who have more or less casual or superficial engagements with yoga. And that is fine too. There's nothing wrong with that, I don't think, either. Mm. But all of those engagements actually depend on people who have dedicated their lives to practicing and to disseminating the practice. So what does it mean to be one of those people, and how does that work? How does that process of dissemination work? And that's really the key to my research question in many ways. And it's applying that research question to a particular subgroup of people. And I think the moment that kind of really stood out for me was, you know, summers in the UK aren't always the most glorious, or like we have interesting summers in the UK. They're usually at the moment in the last kind of 10 years, 15 years or so, we've kind of fallen into a pattern where our weather is beautiful in kind of May, June, July. And by August, it gets a bit like autumn's coming on early, right? And there's one particular camp, which is one of the ones profiled in the book, which is Santosha. And the organizers define Santosha as the happy acceptance of what is. And that really means something when there's a group of you of, say, 200 people or so in a field in Somerset, holding the top of the yurt on because it's raining, you know, it kind of is blowing a gale. No one there is getting any kind of public recognition. So there's no exposure involved in this, because it is, you are just together. About 80% of the people there are yoga teachers. So it's yoga teachers amongst yoga teachers. They're traveling in some cases from across the country or even further afield to come together for these 10 days. They're all chopping vegetables and cleaning the toilets and kind of, you know, working. There's no VIPs, you know what I mean? Everyone's doing, mucking in and doing what they need to do. Mm. And you ask them why they're there, and they say, this fills me up for the year. Mm. This keeps me going. And I think that's fascinating. What is it about those environments and being together in that way and that culture that sustains people, even though it's essentially a lot of teaching for free and a lot of kind of, you know, physical work and some fairly crappy weather a lot of the time. And it's about, I think it was about the community. It's about the bonds that are formed and the ways in which knowledge can be renewed and shared with other people. And these are, if we're going to talk about this specific subculture, these are the kinds of yoga teachers that aren't getting prime time slots in the kind of local, in city center vinyasa flow studios a lot of the time. They are the teachers who are teaching things that are a little bit unusual, a little bit different, you know, that have kind of come to the conclusion maybe that that there are other things to be doing than another sun salutation. There's a lot of bhakti that's going on in those spaces. But again, the bhakti musicians aren't famous. They're not well known. They're singing with the community, of the community. Almost all events that I know of, there's not even a stage. The bhakti musicians kind of align themselves alongside the audience, and everyone faces the altar. As I've already kind of hinted, there's a huge amount of seva and karma yoga that's going on. If you're not prepared to do that karma yoga, you don't tend to get invited back. In fact, if you kind of attempt to volunteer for a lot of these events, like if you email and say, I'm a yoga teacher, I'd like to come and teach at the camp, they say, can you come along and chop some vegetables for the first year until we kind of figure out whether we like you or not? And all of this is kind of deeply reminiscent of the way that grassroots communities form bonds of trust together. And so your standing in those communities is based to a certain extent on a particular kind of perceived authenticity. It's important to say that, you know, I'm not saying these teachers are more authentic. It's about how they construe authenticity together. Yeah. And they do so as a function of how steeped you are in your own practice, you know, whether that people feel you've sold out or not, kind of, you know, how much you mean to the other people there. Like, do you show up? Do you collaborate? Do you share platform with other people? You know, so it's about your connections to other people.
Now, is there is like other festivals I'm more familiar with? I'm just thinking, is there a schedule of kirtan performances, of asana classes, of you know, other rituals or ceremonies? And
I
imagine there's still you know, some teachers probably have some sort of elevated status if, you know, if they're on the schedule, would you say? Or do you think
this is what's interesting, is if you've got 80% of people there who are yoga teachers, there's you know, up to that, some, like I was going to say, as little as 50% of the population, you know, some events is as little as 50%. But there isn't that separation. Obviously there are differences in status, you know, and there are power relationships, and this isn't some form of spiritual utopia that we're talking about. But it is true that teachers are kind of stepping in and out of roles in interesting ways. So, you know, the students in your session, in your 9 o'clock session, are also the people who are on the schedule at 11 o'clock and 3 o'clock, right? Mm-hmm. There's people are kind of dropping into each other's spaces, and schedules evolve in quite dynamic ways, because they have to, because these are kind of ad hoc community events. So things happen and things slide around. Some events pre-print schedules, and then but every morning there'll be a meeting that says, okay, here are all the things that aren't happening, and here are the things that are happening instead. There's a lot of, you know, there's a certain amount of you know, such and such can't make it for the yoga nidra slot at 2 o'clock, can you drop, you know, can anybody drop in and do that? Mm-hmm. So it is not necessarily even by design, but by its nature, it tends to be more egalitarian as a result. It's just the nature of how these spaces work, means that everyone has to kind of muck in together. But obviously, yes, some teachers are more well-known than others, and some teachers get more students than others. But it is, in many ways, it has a different feel. Mm-hmm. And I think partly that's because there are very few ways to make or spend money in those spaces. So there's not a lot you can kind of get out of the other than being with other people and sharing together. And there are spontaneous collaborations that are really interesting that kind of emerge over the course of these events. Because the schedules have a fluidity to them, people will co-teach, kind of, or they'll... you know, people will say, oh, well, you know, I'm doing that 3 o'clock slot, but, you know, I really love the stuff that you're doing with sound at the moment, for example. How do you fancy coming in on my session and doing something with me on this, or so on and so forth? So there's also that, there's that kind of fluidity and collaboration that's happening. People are trying things out because it's low risk, right? People often bring new stuff to try and to teach, and new ways of working that they will explore at these kinds of spaces. And the spaces themselves are porous. And I think that's true of many festivals, mm-hmm. because they're canvas spaces, and schedules do kind of slip a little bit. Everything's on festival time, doesn't necessarily start on time or end on time. I think I say in the book that as a participant, you're wandering around, you kind of find yourself in sessions that you weren't quite sure of what they were. They'd probably be described as something on the schedule you've never heard of before anyway. You know, that may well have shifted locations, and people have swapped tents, and you know, you will find yourself in sessions you didn't intend to be in. You can hear a session happening next door, in the tent next door. So that kind of, there's a bleed through there. So there's a fluidity to the participants as well, and to the students as a result. Mm. And there's one really funny thing someone told me, that at one event that I wasn't at, but I was at one event, and somebody was telling me, I was talking about this fluidity and the lack of kind of mainstream schools of yoga on the schedule. Mm. You know, they're all of the styles listed, kind of, a kind of things you've never heard of before.
So, and like what's on the schedule?
Well, I think that it's because I mean, even when I, because I would teach there, you know, that's one of the participant observation, right? You go and you teach and you do your thing. And I chopped a lot of vegetables as well. And I kind of led a lot of yoga nidra. But I think a lot of these... Not at the same time, no. But a lot of these are teachers that don't necessarily have a specific lineage or brand. So they'll describe themselves in more, in kind of more functional ways. You know, so things will be described as kind of feminine flows, or, you know, they'll be described in kind of more generic ways. Mm. I think when I was always on the schedule, I always tend to go down as wild yoga. Mm-hmm. And people assume that that's kind of a thing. It's not. It's just because my name's Wildcroft. So my website is called Wild Yoga because it was a nice short URL. I have no idea what wild yoga is. But whenever I get put on a schedule, people say, well, what shall I put you down as? And I go, I don't know. They put me down as wild yoga. Mm. So it's those kinds of things. You get people giving descriptions like, oh, it's a bit Scaravelli, and it's a bit, you know, it's a bit womb yoga, and it's a bit this, and it's a bit that. And, so yeah, this one event, apparently, I think it was either an Ashtanga or an Iyengar teacher that kind of turned up at this event for the first time as a participant. And, you know, their mind was blown, like kind of looking at the schedule and going, but how am I supposed to know what I want to go to? I don't know what any of this means.
Right.
And, you know, kind of it's different markers, and there is an experimental side to it as a result.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I got a lot of questions and follow-ups to that, but
I'm sure
to keep us on track, because I think maybe we'll come back to that, because it is interesting thinking about just innovation and the ways in which things are constantly changing and adapting and through experimentation historically and today, and even in this very particular subculture environment. But I think we'll come back to that. But at this point, I really need to ask you, you know, the title of your book is Post-Lineage Yoga. And I think you've been describing it in many different ways already, but especially because, you know, I've seen you've been really public with some of your work online, and maybe we'll talk about that as well. There's been some strange, I think, pushback against it, but I think some confusion over exactly what you mean by this phrase, and I think you spell it out very, very clearly in the book. But for our listeners, or for anybody who's maybe, you know, hearing this phrase for the first time, which actually has gained a bit of cachet already, and you mention at the end of the book there's, you know, some people have started to use it in other contexts. So tell us, so to set the record straight and tell us you know, exactly what you mean by this phrase, kind of how this came about. What is post-lineage yoga?
Yeah. So I think that the subculture that I describe in the book is uniquely experimental, uniquely fluid. And I think that's because, not necessarily because these teachers are uniquely experimental and fluid in how they do yoga. I think this is where they come to do that experimentation, and to do that exchange, and to have that fluidity, and to play and explore together. I think it's kind of different back in back when they go home again in many ways. But as a result, I think it's reflective of processes that we see much more common than we realize. And the problem with describing something that hasn't been noticed before is, even when you describe it accurately, people have problems grasping it. Not because they can't understand the idea, but because it doesn't fit with our view of how the world is at the moment. So people, the part of my frustration is in this division of modern yoga and contemporary yoga. So first of all, that we confuse those two things, because, you know, early, like 20th century yoga and 21st century yoga are not the same thing, in my view.
Good point.
You know, but, you know, so A, we kind of collapse it all down into one thing, and B, what we do is we kind of have supposedly traditional yoga over here, and that is always as close as possible to Guru Shishya transmission. It's as close as possible to a known lineage, and yet somehow also involves direct contact with some guru. So you're kind of part of multi-million dollar brands, but somehow you've also got this badge of authenticity that somehow connects you to something pre-modern involving small groups of saddies in India. So, you know, there's all of that. And then over here, you have the kind of commercial yoga. And that's terrible and we hate it. And it's probably American it's probably, you know, it's probably got a Lululemon brand on it somewhere. And the idea there's nothing in between. And what this does is it sets up two camps of yoga. And what I see particularly on social media online is yoga teachers, all of whom believe that they have the authentic true yoga, fighting with other yoga teachers that they believe to be part of this commercial structure. And it's not getting us anywhere as a conversation. There are important things to be said, and I talk about them in the book, about commercialization, about exploitation, about cultural appropriation, about all these things. However, what's actually happening on the ground, I think, is something different. And if we take, rather than taking a historical movement for the moment, let's take the individual yoga teacher. I think there comes a point in many yoga teachers' lives, wherever you are and whenever you are, where what your teacher gave you wasn't enough on its own. And that doesn't mean to say that you lose necessarily your love for that teacher, but that you look to outside sources in some way or another for corroboration, for development, for change. I don't think that it is, if you're, for example, an Iyengar yoga teacher, I don't think it's somehow a betrayal of Iyengar to be looking at the latest research into joint biomechanics, you know, because, you know, Iyengar didn't have access to that information when he wrote Light on Yoga, and that was published in, 1963. We're allowed to evolve and we're allowed to change. So I think that there is so much research, interestingly, being done into both the history of yoga and contemporary issues in yoga, that there is a lot that we cannot expect our teachers to gift us. And I know that when I did my early teacher trainings, we were basically told that yoga, quote unquote, was 10,000 years old. Mm-hmm. And there was kind of an assumption that sun salutations had been around for thousands of years. And also it was definitely good for you. And that had definitely been proven. Neither of those things were true, even if it wasn't ancient and even if it wasn't scientifically proven, it definitely made you a better person, right?
Right. I mean, I share in that experience. And
yeah,
to their credit, it was before this kind of wave and explosion of more critical yoga scholarship and history. However, you and I both know that is being taught today in a lot of yoga teacher training spaces. So it's not as if, that's something outdated that we now, can move on from. So,
yes. So there comes some sort of in some cases it is a crisis of faith. I mean, certainly I think for Anusara teachers, for many of us, it was a crisis of faith. It was, it was half of what we've been taught suddenly feels like a lie. And certainly for me, I was teaching more and more people for whom these supposedly universal principles of alignment weren't universal. They weren't working. When we were getting kind of chronic back pain and various other things from the practice. And it turns out maybe there is more than one way to practice yoga and to practice asana.
Well, if John Friend had just called them the relative principles of
alignment, we'd be fine, right? We'd have been okay. And we also have to, say, obviously there's more, as many people will tell you, there's more to yoga than asana, right? That it is, there were teachers also looking to expand their understanding of things like, kind of having access to real in-depth scholarship on pre-modern philosophical sources, on Bhakti sources, on these kinds of things as well. And the hunger, and it's a beautiful thing, right? The hunger of yoga teachers to really find out more and more and more about everything from how fascia works in the body to can we learn Sanskrit and read the sutras in the quote unquote in the original? That is an amazing and beautiful thing. So then you sit that alongside a form of transmission that says the more, the closer your source of knowledge is to a single line of lineage, one teacher to one teacher to one teacher to one teacher, one teacher, the more authentic it is. And that doesn't make sense. Those two things do not sit by side by side. They don't work. So post-lineage yoga is the move of many yoga teachers to find ways to not ditch the teachings as they were given them, but to kind of sit alongside those other forms of expert knowledge, and above all, to connect with other yoga teachers from diverse environments. And when it gets really interesting for me is when teachers from different schools with different teachers come together and share with each other. And that's exciting, because rather than being in these little kind of bubbles of knowledge, these silos of knowledge that go down through time, you know, it's always interesting if a Scaravelli teacher has a conversation. I mean, my goodness, Scaravelli teachers having conversations with our younger teachers is fascinating. Mm. You know, these different conceptions of how bodies work. And it's interesting to me that in many ways, the Bhakti tradition has much of a stronger sense of Sangha, of community, of coming together. And it has that kind of almost built in. And for me, post-lineage yoga is recognizing that within what we know to be modern yoga. So these are grassroots networks of knowledge and ways of understanding these kind of amorphous grassroots networks that have been recognized in all sorts of cultures across time and across the world. So in that, I'm really leaning on a lot of scholarship that's been done before on informal education processes. And then the really exciting bit is that now when I speak, sometimes when I speak to historians of pre-modern yoga, they say, well, you know, outside of the kind of systems, the hierarchies of knowledge that we know, we suspect that maybe, you know, there was a lot more borrowing, a lot more sharing than is formally written down.
Yeah.
Because our ideas of authenticity, like if we want to prove our authenticity, we always say, oh, well, it's 10,000 years old and it comes from, you know, a single unbroken line of tradition. So I'm interested into how much a post-lineage way of working, A, how much it actually supports lineage structures in many ways, because it's a corrective to that system, but also how widespread it might be in many ways. I haven't found an environment it doesn't apply to yet. So that's interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So many interesting things here on the historical front, because that's where my mind was kind of immediately going, you know, because of the source text that I'm, you know, immersed in. And even the more recent history of modern yoga in the early 20th mm-hmm. century, you know, the mm-hmm. work of Singleton and Stjoman and so many others now. I mean, the first thing is that, the idea of, first of all, this idea of the singular traditional, you know, Hatha yoga, you know, even in this so-called Hatha yoga renaissance at that period, it immediately falls apart when you see that figures like Krishnamacharya and Shivananda and Kuvalyananda were integrating all kinds of different mind, body, you know, physical, cultural disciplines and systems, right?
Yeah.
So
they were allowed to.
But what they did, you know, and I think it's part of the Indian tradition is to do this. In part of the adopting and adaptation is to integrate new things, but within the veil of tradition and authenticity. So by kind of framing things, and this is not new. This is what, you know, the study of these medieval Sanskrit yoga texts shows us was kind of always happening, but in different flavors, in different ways. This balance of tradition and innovation,
but always the claim to tradition is bound up with a claim to power, right? And that's not just true of Indian tradition. I think that's across the world.
Absolutely.
I mean, as a religion studies scholar, you would know all religions, all cultures are syncretic. They're always evolving, and they're always pretending that we've been doing things for 10,000 years.
Like I was thinking, you know, because this is something I think about in looking at this kind of what I call like a network of yoga shastras.
Okay. Yeah.
Like we now know that all of these authors were borrowing from one another. There's cutting, copying and pasting. There's Sometimes there's recognition of a text, you know, through acknowledging the title, but usually not. And that there was clearly like manuscripts that were moving and libraries and personal collections, and that the authors were, there's a conversation that's happening across and within these Sanskrit texts. And so there's different mechanisms for authorizing innovation and adaptation that's going on in these texts. One of them, for example, is to, you know, ascribe the teachings to God, to Shiva, right? So, you know, if...
So that's your lineage, right? That's the ultimate lineage,
That's the
right?
ultimate, that's the Adi Guru.
So the top, right?
if in the Viveka Martunda it says that there's 84,000 asanas, it only teaches two of them. But we've established here that Shiva has taught this innumerable amount of asanas. So any asana that develops over time, you kind of have...
That's an original.
That's an original. It was taught by Shiva. Like it can kind of... You've already got this kind of system that allows to check out. Yeah. So, okay, back to what you were saying. One is that...
Can I just say, though, I think one of the... this, because I think this is really important. I think one of the gifts of religious studies, as it's taught in many places in scholarship today, is the really deep understanding that that too is a form of truth. Now, what we're not saying is that makes these things false. That's not what we're saying here. I think good religious studies scholars are able to sit with different kinds of truth and different kinds of reality. And I see those legends as having as much truth as anything else, you know, because they're expressing something. They're expressing something real, and so nobody's saying that they were lying. That's not what we were saying, you know. No, I don't think it's important whether, you know, scrolls were eaten by ants or not eaten by ants. I'm more interested in what it means to say they were eaten by ants and you can't read them.
Yeah, it's what we'd call kind of the strategies of meaning making, you know, that's happening, that are culturally specific, text specific. But the point, the other point here really is so to acknowledge that if we're talking about innovation and cross-disciplinary things happening across lineages, across, you know, trans-sectarian sometimes is a word that's used. If we're talking about Shaivas and Vaishnavas and Buddhists and Jains kind of borrowing and exchanging, you know, a quick glance at the history of yoga reveals, right, that is obviously the case. So I think that's a constant, right? That's not new. Yet there is something different going on in the Guru Shishya Parampara style of transmission, right? That I think is very distinct, that is really specific. All of these texts talk about the guru. And there's some texts that even say, if you go to another guru, something bad will happen to you. Or, you know, if you... Actually, my text that I'm translating says, if you give this text to somebody who is not worthy of this text, which is actually to say someone who's not a Shaiva, it'll actually bring disrepute and bad karma, basically, on you and your guru.
I think that I think it is something specific. And one of the ways that I like to talk about it with yoga teachers is that we've taken something that's very specific about a particular form of religious knowledge transmission, and we've attempted to replicate that across schools with thousands and thousands of yoga teachers in them. And what we fail to recognize is that modern lineages, from, you know, as they come, as they become transnational, as they move beyond India, are not the same thing as those Guru Shishya Parampara traditions. They are as modern as they are traditional. And, you know, everything that we think of as, or many of the things that I think people have tended to consider as traditional yoga, is actually also a product of modernity and a product of encounters with certain kinds of business and commercial structures in many ways. And that's not a problem. I mean, if you're looking to disseminate a particular practice form across the world, then one of the fastest and most reliable ways of doing that is to standardize it, to create, you know, insurance systems and documentation and certificates and you know, and teacher training schools in Bahamas and all of that kind of thing. That is a thing to do, and it is, I don't think anyone's saying that's not legitimate. I'm saying let's not pretend that that isn't also a radical departure from what happened before. And that served a particular point in time for a particular kind of yoga. It served us very, very well. But we are allowed to evolve and change, even as they were allowed to evolve and change. You know, I mean, Shivananda was the first person to, wasn't he offering spiritual initiation on receipt of a postal order? I mean, if you want to talk about who's commercialized yoga, you kind of, how far back do you go?
Right. I think SRF and Yogananda were doing something of that sort. I don't know if they considered it initiation, but you were there were certainly mail order courses that you could kind of learn from the guru like that.
Okay.
So just to kind of nail this kind of down even further to clarify what we are and what you are not saying post-lineage yoga is. So I've heard, you know, I've seen online some of the critics on social media have claimed that that post-lineage yoga is anti-lineage and anti-guru.
Yeah.
So,
well, it's really simple. If it was anti-lineage, I'd have called it anti-lineage yoga. I you know, this is where I have to do that thing of saying I'm an academic. I'm quite careful with the words that I choose. And as you can imagine, that I didn't choose this term lightly. It took 2 years of back and forth with my supervisors, with them saying, so what is this? And they said things like, do you mean these people are anti-lineage? And I said, no, it's more than that. It's different to that. Because some of these people have very close connections to their teachers and their gurus still. But that doesn't stop them wanting to hang out and exchange with people from other systems.
Right.
So there is, I think it was, it's a term that has come under different forms of criticism. But Linda Woodhead talked about post-Christianity at a particular point in time. And the idea of post-Christianity, as she theorizes it, is that is the difference between being connected to the institutions of Christianity and being connected to the practice of Christianity. Suppose Christianity is people who may not have a local church and so on and so forth, but they still consider themselves to be Christians. They still do all the things that Christians do. So, you know, there's also a nod to that in this formulation. It's a post word, not because it's because it's not an anti word. It's a movement beyond that still therefore is in relationship with lineage. Right. It is very much about where do I go from here and how do I reconcile and honor the sources and the teachers that I have, whilst also honoring this development and this new information and this new research that's coming to me. And the other thing I think that's really important to remember is that although there are people within this community that are my friends, although I've spent a lot of time kind of investigating my own positionality within this community, as an academic, it is my job to describe phenomena. And no one kind of has a go at geologists for describing earthquakes.
Right. Yeah, I do think sometimes it's lost on
it is
people outside of academic circles, the difference between what we might call descriptive versus prescriptive, you know, work, right? So you as a religious studies scholar are describing using a new, you know, creating a term, however imperfect it is, but using it to try to describe the phenomena that you're seeing, using
so that
it to
we can
draw,
investigate it and
to,
talk about
to
it.
Draw some boundaries around a thing, even if it's to poke at them.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Which is different than saying this is not, you know, a prescriptive term, or saying that, you know, we should be, regardless of what you actually think, you know, not saying that we should move past lineages, no, and we should
absolutely not.
Right. Yeah.
No. If I thought I knew how yoga should be practiced and how yoga should be taught, then I think I'd have done something different than a PhD in religious studies. I don't know what I'd be doing, but you know, it would be involved some kind of mega brand.
Right. Well, I guess you could have just
trademarks with my name on it, or
written the best-selling book, and you wouldn't have needed the PhD. And
absolutely, this is how you should be teaching yoga.
Now the subtitle of the book is From Guru to #MeToo. And you know, when we think about this notion of post-lineage yoga, again, just if we just look at this moment of where yoga is right now, in 2021, 21st century. I mean, even leaving aside the pandemic and COVID and everything that's totally shifted the industry, you know, in the last year. But even before that, I think the big kind of seismic, you know, events really that have been happening in the yoga world is the collapse of, you know, guru system, you know, sexual abuse or power abuse. From guru to guru to guru, it's hard to point a finger at a modern yoga community that has not been affected by this.
I don't believe there is one. I don't believe there is one.
Yeah.
I think we're at that point. I think you know, it's not that many years ago when I was still saying to people, well, you know, at least we still have Satyananda and Shivananda. And now here we are.
Yeah. Trying to think. I hope that there's some exceptions to that.
And it's heartbreaking, right?
It is. It absolutely is. And so many people's lives and families and so much that has been torn apart through that.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to sit here and analyze it, but we're really talking about people's lives. It's absolutely heartbreaking. So on the one hand, We have this, right, that is happening and still unfolding, and all of these communities who are reconciling and grappling with all of these complex issues. We also, but even actually before, though, all of those that was coming to light, and victims coming forth with testimonials, and the work of, you know, Matthew Remsky and many others who were kind of highlighting a lot of this. We also, I'm not the first to notice this by any means, but so many of the seminal gurus, Indian gurus of modern postural yoga, were dying, passing away, right, in the last few decades. Yeah. And I saw that as a really interesting turning point into not necessarily a post-lineage yoga, but in a post-guru yoga. Because just a generation, a pivotal generation of Indian yoga gurus that had passed away, and the fallout from that, even, like institutionally, and you know, the close students of those gurus then, you know, spreading teachings in very different ways, has led to I think just kind of a new wave of modern yoga. But now with the Me Too movement and there's so much that is now collapsing and being having to be reconstructed. So I don't know. I think a lot of that is really important when we talk about lineage and post-lineage yoga. Yeah. Because I think there's so many people who are not necessarily in that British subculture at those festivals, but who operate in these yoga spaces, whether they're mainstream yogis or maybe more these subcultural yogis, but who do not identify with a particular lineage or a guru, and who are kind of floating between styles and classes and this more peer-based network of the transmission of teachings and practice. Now who are taking classes with everybody online. Do you know what I mean? So Does those sort of yogis who are outside of a specific lineage, do you see them as falling within this category of post-lineage, or are you talking about something more specific to this British subcultural milieu?
I think it's an interesting one, because I think that in some ways, people who've, you know, never felt that they've had a connection to a particular teacher or a particular style, in some ways their natural home is post-lineage environments. But in some ways they're also, it's not, because in some ways they're not, like, there's not the same process that people go through. So I think what's interesting about the kind of Meta yoga and yoga movement is all of those, again, really quite heartbreaking conversations and reconciliations that people have to make about the styles that they practice, and the things that they've devoted their lives to. And, you know, the very idea that somebody could have been on the mat next to you and could suffer terrible violence at the same time as you're finding liberation and transcendence. And, you know, there's a lot of glib things and easy answers that people talk about in terms of, separating the teacher from the teachings and all of these kinds of things. And I don't think it begins to come close to the kinds of internal work that has to happen and the kinds of community work that has to happen in these spaces. And I think very few are the communities of yoga practitioners that have been able to continue beyond those kinds of revelations. Most of them fracture. The people involved go on to other communities and other spaces, but I think it is difficult to still see that as a home. I think it's a story that's much older in some ways than we often recognize. I know that when I think in many ways my first encounter with kind of post-lineage environments was on a Yoga Nidra course being run by Uma Dismortuli, who's profiled in my book. And this is years ago when the Anusara scandal was kind of really at its height and it was all kicking off, and I just didn't know what to think anymore about all of this stuff. How much of the practice, how much of the joy that I'd found was to do with the community of people locally that I was practicing with, how much of it was to do with the system, how much of it was my own experience, how much of it was shared, all of these different things. And I was kind of sat in the kitchen that, you know, often at these events, you know, you're having tea and kind of in the break. And I remember the older female yoga teachers kind of almost patting me on the shoulder and going, it's okay, you know, you're one of us now. Because all of them had been through some sort of similar revelation kind of had to reconcile in some ways. I think what's different now is the ability that we have to share that understanding and that knowledge. So rather than being a series of we've gone from it being a series of individual revelations and individual crises of faith to a point where schools and lineages seem to be going through them one at a time. So each lineage would go through it and you'd see them go through the same processes. You know, when the Ashtanga story really hit, you know, I really wanted to take a lot of my Ashtanga yoga teacher friends and go and tell them, go and talk to the Satyananda people, go and talk to the people who've been through this, because you think that what you're going through is unique and it's not. You are going through something as a community that other people have been through. And there is, you know, there is wisdom there that you can find on the other side. And I think now we're at a point where we're realizing it's more than just the gurus. You know, you talk about this being a post-guru moment. I think it's more than that. The Me Too conversations, I think, at least before the start of COVID, were starting to turn much more towards structural issues and transmission issues. How do we get consent for the ways in which we touch students, for example? What does it mean to be in altered states of consciousness side by side in different kinds of practices? You know, how do we create safety? And I think some of that is also driven by the increasing desire to use certain forms of yoga practice, you know, the kind of more mainstream acceptable forms of yoga practice as an adjunct therapy. And if you're going to use yoga therapeutically, the kind of medical professionals, educational professionals and care professionals involved in that process who are commissioning that work and inviting you in, they need to know that it's safe. And they need to know that they're not bringing, you know, problematic dynamic, interpersonal dynamics into the room as well. Mm-hmm. So I think it's wider. I think we're starting to have conversations around that. But then, of course, that's all been thrown up in the air by the COVID situation. I was gathering quite a collection of consent chips. Everyone was starting to use them.
Right.
And I remember when you couldn't find, you know, there were like two places in the world that had consent chips. And then it came to a point where everyone was doing it. And of course, now everyone's online. No one's touching anyone anymore.
No, but
it turns
now
out.
There's different layers of consent online. So at some point during the pandemic, yeah. I'm sure you and others have noticed this, but Zoom, changed a setting where I could, mm-hmm. as the host of the Zoom meeting, I could no longer unmute somebody without their consent. So I had to ask mm-hmm. someone to unmute them,
yeah.
Which is nice. That's considerate. So that, yeah, you know, yeah, if they've yeah. got something going on in the background or they're not ready or they don't want to, they don't have to. Mm-hmm. But that was an interesting overnight change. Mm-hmm. Not that Zoom was necessarily coming at it from these perspectives, although some of this might have been there, broader issue of consent that is obviously yeah. because a lot of the issues that we're describing, unfortunately, are not unique to the yoga world, right?
Absolutely
and
not.
Are much
no,
broader
absolutely not.
To societies. Mm.
So I think that in the same way as, you know, there are revelation, there's access to new research and new information, and that changes your understanding of authority in yoga, and people start to have more complex relationships with authority. I think in the same way, the kind of Me Too movement is provoking a reassessment of relationship and interpersonal relationship in the classroom. And I think in some ways, it's a generalization, but in some ways, the defining feature of modern yoga and contemporary yoga compared to pre-modern yoga is people practicing in a room together on a scale that we've never seen before. And there are dynamics and things that happen when people practice side by side. And we haven't really begun to investigate what pedagogical tools we would really need to do that safely and effectively and consensually. You know, what does it mean? And I think, you know, sometimes I say to yoga teachers, for me personally, if you ask me as a yoga teacher rather than as a researcher, consent is the heart and center of yoga teaching. You know, what relationship are you building with your students? What are they consenting to? At its best, a yoga practice should be something that's transformative in some way. And if it's transformative in some way, that's a precious space. And therefore it matters. It matters how much the person in front of me is consenting to what's going on. And do they have the information to consent to that?
I think some people feel concerned online, at least I can see. Mm. But I understand where they're coming from. You know, when they hear a conversation like this or they see discussion about post-lineage yoga, mm-hmm. and they think that that is an attack on both lineage-based yoga, but then with that on kind of this guru shishya or, you know, the guru model. And I think what some fear might get lost is that if you then move away from this idea of mentorship and moving to this completely relativized, more democratic peer-to-peer network of the exchange, that there is something lost in somebody having mastery over a discipline or a body of knowledge. If everybody is an equal educator,
I'm talking about peer networks of knowledge between teachers, not peer networks of knowledge where teachers don't have a body of knowledge. I'm saying without. What I'm questioning or what I'm kind of interested in is exactly how do you judge mastery if that isn't ratified by a hierarchy? And that's not me saying you can do that. That's me saying that is a difficult thing. And how does it happen in practice?
Right, because typically it would be the shishyas or the students that recognize the mastery of a student or of a teacher, rather. And you're saying
vice versa, you know, the teacher kind of, you know, decides which students are ready to step into the role of teacher or not.
Sure.
So if we are moving in these kind of free flowing environments, power still exists in those environments, abuse still exists in those environments. So how are we navigating mastery? How are we recognizing things like charisma and talent and depth of practice? And how are we negotiating those things and navigating those things? Which is why, you know, that's why it's an 80,000 word book rather than just a 3-page article.
So I find the category really useful. I think we have to be really specific about what we mean when we use it. But one, you know, reservation I have, not only with this category, but really any of these categories, modern yoga, modern postural yoga, transnational Anglophone yoga, you know, any of these, is that sometimes they start to gain this cachet and then they sort of become reified into this sort of thing. And there's certain moments in the book where I even read it where it's like you're saying such and such has been practicing post-lineage yoga for a long time, or something like that. Mm. And it strikes you as then almost as if, and I know this is not your intention at all, it's the opposite, but there's almost like a branding that happens. There's almost like, okay, well, this sounds like something distinctive, a distinct style of yoga. And
of course, if you reify it, then it stops being post-lineage. By definition, because post lineage by definition isn't reified. It's a weird kind of paradox. But you're right. I think that's more true since the research has become more common and people have started to use the term and use the term politically. And I find that both fascinating and uncomfortable in equal measure. But it's a common problem for any researchers of contemporary phenomena, right? I'm sure Elizabeth de Michaelis kind of, you know, there's a sense in which you kind of both bless and curse the moment where the community becomes aware of the categorizations that you're using because they become associated with certain groups of people. And I have seen that. I've seen the hashtag post-lineage used as an anti-guru thing, which makes me quite uncomfortable in many ways.
It's important to acknowledge that then.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be sure to leave links in the show notes to the post-lineage yoga teacher training program. Just kidding.
TM. Just kidding. Registered with Yoga Alliance.
Of course, you do teach on yoga teacher training programs, as do I.
I do.
Actually, I wanted to read this quote that's at the very end and talk to you a little bit about this, about shifting roles and positionality of the scholar and thinking a little bit too about the scholar practitioner. But you write at the end of the book, my positionality as researcher, consultant, and facilitator becomes ever more complex to navigate.
It does. And
I know exactly what you mean. The categories and the quote-unquote traditional spaces that the academic or the scholar, the researcher might find themselves in, those are really breaking down. I think we're both actually doing important work in breaking down some of those barriers.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit, though, about... about that, the complexity of navigating those roles, but maybe we can focus specifically on, you know, this phrase or this category of the scholar practitioner. We started all this, the book project came from your experiences in the field
as a
teacher practitioner. I said, are they teaching yoga? You said, yeah, I was teaching yoga in these spaces. So that's extremely important. And in fact, it enabled you to carry out this work. You know, had you had you simply been an outsider to that community, a kind of anthropologist coming in and doing just this kind of observational study, it would have looked and felt extremely different. Talk a little bit about that in terms of how you've navigated that in your work.
Mm. Yeah, I think the first stages and the first steps in that were in many ways methodological. I think it's interesting. One of the things that's interesting to me that is in other kind of semi-related subjects, this is less of an issue. So if you are a scholar in dance studies, for example, it would be weird not to dance, not to be a dancer. Like that would be strange. I mean, you know, it does exist, but it's a little bit of a strange thing to do if you're a musicologist.
The armchair dance scholar. I'm sure that exists, but...
But the same in other kind of arts professions, kind of musicology and so on. So there is a long tradition of that. And I really needed to lean methodologically on those environments, on those scholarly environments, for kind of ways of understanding how we move through the field. And it is a form of intellectual honesty in many ways. There's something for me, very uncomfortable about the idea of the anthropologist dropping in out of nowhere and, you know, tell me, tribal people, what is going on in your life. Like there's something very colonial and very white about that, very 19th century. Yeah. So there's a book that I really love that I highly recommend to anyone who's an anthropologist of contemporary practice of all different kinds. And that's Ruth Bihar's The Vulnerable Observer. And Ruth Bihar talks a lot about what it means to be invested in communities and speaking for them. And this idea of speaking for untold stories and marginalized voices. And my supervisor, or one of my supervisors, is Willem Beckelig, who is not as well known as he should be, in my opinion. His work is fascinating. Mm. But the other one is Graham Harvey. And Graham Harvey's not a yoga specialist, but he is a specialist on animist and indigenous religions in many ways. And he talks about anthropology, or the best kind of anthropology and ethnography, as a form of methodological guesthood. So if you're a guest, then you have rights and you have responsibilities. It's a negotiation. You're not at home, but neither are you a stranger. You're a guest in the field, and how you navigate and that has certain has an ethical dimension to it. You have a responsibility to represent the community fairly, but also not be overly over romanticized them. So he talks about kind of walking that line. So you know, to borrow from the kind of yoga environment that I knew and loved, I started to talk about my research as a form of methodological saver. Or Karma Yoga, that I am working in service of the communities that I'm studying, but not in service, not slavishly, you know, that it is my responsibility to reflect as best I can the things that I see in ways that hopefully help conversations to happen, so the community can see itself more clearly and understand its processes more clearly. But I also believe everything about my research and the way I do things would confirm that I believe in a plurality of voices and a diversity of voices. And in fact, a lot of my academic work has, it's unusual for me to work in isolation. My first peer-reviewed article was a collaboration. I'm interested in the ways in which we can produce knowledge as communities as much as individuals. Mm. So then, you know, all of those flows of power and authority come in. So on the one hand, you have the kind of embodied knowledge of being a yoga teacher and what that means, you know, the different forms of practice that I am used to practicing that feel good for me, that feel right, have an impact on how I experience the field. So that actually involves yogic skills of discernment and self-awareness to know that, you know, just for an example, if I'm not enjoying that Kundalini yoga session that I'm doing in that festival, it's because I don't like it rather than because it has any particular issue as a form, right? There's and so actually being in the field in some ways took me well out of my comfort zone, because it was incumbent on me to experience the widest possible range of practices, even if they were the ones that I wouldn't normally do. That was really interesting, as well as very tiring. Mm. And you know, I had to interrogate why these practices were uncomfortable to me personally and why I didn't like them so much. It's just, you know, it turns out with Kundalini yoga, I think it's just the way my nervous system works. I get quite agitated quite quickly. So I'm just not very good at it as a result. So there's all of that is going on, that kind of embodied skill set and what that means for who you are. But that is never a neutral position. We are never a neutral body within the field, mm-hmm. and we can never be a neutral scholar. So I think there's an honesty to talking about that methodologically. But I do think that there's something different that happens at the other end of this. I think there's still quite a rosy view of how academia works, and certainly. Academia has changed a lot in the last 20 years. I think it would surprise many of your listeners to know how precarious our work is, how little money we earn, and how hard we work for in many ways for very little reward. Nobody is in the field of yoga studies because it's going to get them a solid, easy job.
Yeah.
We're in it because there's something about this community and this culture that we find fascinating and we want to talk about. So, you know, if you're wondering why I was looking at this particular community in a field, one was because it was in many ways uniquely interesting. But there's also, I have to be honest, because I could afford to. Mm. You know, and people have said to me, oh, you know, why weren't you studying kind of communities in India? I don't have the money. I literally don't have the money or the access to do that. So as a result, there is increasingly, I think, a community of alternative academics who may or may not have got to the end of the PhD process, but who are working outside or on the edges of the academic community in many ways. So my position at SOAS, for example, I can be honest with you and with your listeners, it's 14 hours a week and I'm in professional services. I'm not an academic as I'm employed there. That might lead to other things, but, you know, it's not earning me significant amounts of money.
Well, yogic studies, I mean, I consider yogic studies as an alternative educational institute. It's not that our courses are free, although we work with people, but considerably less than what you would pay at a traditional university to get access to these sort of teachings.
So I think whereas maybe 30 years ago, you know, we'd have both probably been working very much within an institution and doing this stuff on the side because we want to give back to the community in different ways. Now for many of us, this becomes a significant part of our income and working with those communities. And that keeps us honest in some ways because we are accountable to those communities and those cultures, but it makes things tricky. But I think I take those same skills and that same awareness of positionality into everything that I do.
Yeah.
So when I'm training yoga teachers, when they ask me questions, I will say, who are you asking when you ask that question? If you're asking for my opinion of this thing, are you asking me as a researcher, i.e., you know, what would my research participants on average say? Are you asking me as a practitioner or are you asking me as a teacher?
Yeah.
And I think those skills and that self-reflection around positionality is something that's very useful to have. And I would like more yoga teachers to have it. You know, when someone's asking you whether or not you think this particular brand of supplement powder is good for them, how are you answering that question? Are you answering that question as a nutritionist, as a yoga teacher, as a friend? You know, from what position? Because when people come to you for knowledge, it's important for you to be honest about the source that your knowledge comes from.
Right.
It's absolutely okay to say, I find that this particular practice really helps my backache. So long as you're clear that knowledge is anecdotal and it's coming from you rather than from a double-blind peer-reviewed study of 4,000 people that was published in The Lancet. So I think that positionality is important in and of itself. And I think it's a form of intellectual honesty that's not easy to navigate, but I think it's useful.
I agree. And I bring a lot of those themes. I think that's kind of how we're trained, certainly in religious studies, to think through those kind of multiple truths and positionality and to have that kind of self-reflexivity. And also to see, I think anybody who does a PhD in anything, but in the humanities in particular, to just know how anything you're saying is kind of built on the shoulder of giants and the kind of the communal production of knowledge and the humility to be able to say what we do know and the much bigger gaps of where we don't know. And those are not the norms in like a yoga teacher training space. That is not the pedagogical model where it's and this has been so problematic for so long that the yoga teacher is like put up on this pedestal and assumed to know everything about the subtle yogic body, about the yoga sutras, about alignment, about diet, about all of these things, right? That they are not qualified perhaps to speak about. So yeah, I think bringing some of these, the academic skill set and training of how we think through knowledge and education is incredibly important in its transparency.
And how we allow research to evolve. Like, you know, post-linear yoga is a model for understanding practice. It's a model for understanding practice. And, someone will come up with a newer one and a better one. And that'll be a really exciting moment. And then we can get to talk about that model and so on and so on. Right. I don't think people really understand how rigorous and endless that process is, even for such things as historical study. You know, the assumption is once we know the history of something, then that kind of stays as it is. There's always more research. There's always more to find out. There's always more to know. And that allows a humility in terms of, you know, what you know, what you figured out for yourself in your own work, but also allows you to really honor and respect the knowledge of people who came before you, because you know that they were doing the best they had with the information they had at that particular time as well. Yeah. And I think that it's, you know, obviously it's not always like that. Academia can be a terrible and horrible place in many ways sometimes, but at its best, it's a community of people who champion the evolution of human knowledge and recognize that we're all doing the best we can, you know.
There's a lot of problems with academia and higher ed today. Yeah. Just take one glance at academic Twitter and I've had to kind of get off there because it can be really toxic, actually.
There's a lot of people shafting each other's ideas and all sorts.
I wanted to go back to, you know, we're going to start to wind down here, I wanted to go back to this thing about the scholar practitioner, and you brought up the example about the musicologist or the dance scholar, and like nobody would scoff. In fact, people would be surprised if you didn't dance yourself or if you didn't play the saxophone or something like that, and yet you dedicated your life to studying music theory. I think there is an important difference there, that in that, you know, I think the scholar practitioner question is very unique within the history of the discipline of religious studies and as an outgrowth out of, you know, theological study, right? That needs to be acknowledged. But yoga sort of operates in this sort of strange liminal place within and outside of religious studies. And I think one of the key differences, right, between the musicologist and the religious studies scholar practitioner is that there's not an assumption necessarily that the saxophone scholar practitioner holds a particular, you know, ideology or you know, faith commitment because of his or her practice of the saxophone. And that's going to somehow obscure or shape or frame, you know, the scholarship. Whereas the religious studies scholar, and this is even more apparent in, you know, Christianity studies or Jewish studies or even, you know, Buddhist and Hindu studies, even more, it's more defined in those areas, because those mm-hmm. identities are more clearly defined, I think, to be, you know, a Jew and a scholar of the Hebrew Bible. Mm. Whereas yoga is more nebulous, yeah. right? Because what does it mean to be a practitioner of yoga, right?
Yeah.
You can yeah. simply do asana and just physical yeah. practice and identify as a practitioner and then study some aspect of yoga and you're a scholar practitioner. So anyways, I just wanted to, not that we're going to answer any of that right now, but to kind of highlight
right.
those vexed kind of areas and differences that are
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah, I think it really comes as well from, I think it comes from a historical development that you will be aware of within the development of religious studies as a discipline, and the ongoing uncomfortable, hopefully productively uncomfortable relationship between theology and religious studies in many ways. I mean, one of the best ways to annoy a religious studies scholar is to accuse them of being a theologian.
That's right.
In my experience, it really gets people a bit twitchy.
That's right. Which is the common response when you tell somebody you're getting a PhD in the study of religion, they say, you know, you're going to seminary or you're studying to be a priest or a rabbi.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you do my wedding?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I think that it's important to note that religious studies grows out of trying to take either an anthropological or a sociological approach to studying religion as a phenomenon rather than to what are the fundamental human truths. I think that therefore is a tricky one. I think it helps that for many contemporary yoga cultures and environments tend to be quite henotheistic. They tend to be very accepting that there are multiple ways to the truth. So the fact that you are a Shiva devotee and someone else is a Vishnu devotee and so on, it's, you know, we can all sing kirtan together, right? And so I know that there is sectarianism does exist, but I think that side by side with that, there are also really strong traditions of inclusivity and kind of interfaith that do go on in those environments. And it's interesting that if you look at my research, that in some ways the community relations that are happening in those environments are modeled as much on kind of interfaith bhakti communities as they are on asana traditions. So it's the ways in which Babaji and Amma devotees will get together and sing together that sets the tone for how different styles of yoga will start to practice side by side. So I think it helps that we have that tradition, at least with many caveats going alongside that. It's something that I think we're still quite uncomfortable talking about. I'm uncomfortable talking about as the one thing I don't tend to do is talk about, the theological aspects of yoga, not because I'm not aware of the philosophies and traditions involved, but because I do think that that's something that I need to bracket out of my research relationships and teaching relationships. And I have a tradition, and in that respect, I have a tradition, and it's not a yogic one, interestingly. That has a lineage, interestingly. But but it's within a pagan tradition,
right?
So,
well, the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra says, whether a Brahmana, a Jaina, a Kapalika, or a pagan, if you practice the methods of Hatha Yoga, you'll attain success.
So, I will practice. So it's interesting that because of the way these things work, the SOAS Center of Yoga Studies now is beamed from my practice room. And if you kind of really peer at it, you'll notice that I'm sitting on a very big yoga mat in front of my laptop. But behind me is a 3-foot long altar. And there are a lot of things on that altar.
we will wait for the anthropology of Theo's Zoom room from the SOAS event.
Absolutely. I think it's not something I would want to kind of gloss over as an issue thing to talk about. I think that the difference perhaps is that those of us who not necessarily, but those of us who work in the way that I have, have, because of the participant observation, the nature of participant observation, then I am honest about my positionality as a practitioner.
Yeah.
I think sometimes it's thought that somehow I'm unusual in that. What if we go back to that conference in Krakow? I remember a discussion, a kind of whole group discussion, where somebody asked how many people. This is a room full of yoga scholars, international yoga scholars. How many people in this room would put their hands up and say that they were yoga practitioners in a room full of other scholars? And 80% of the hands in the room went up.
I remember that. I think it was Borian, Larios,
asking the fun question.
The question. I was one of those hands that shot out, and I was definitely peeking around the room to see who else had their hand
who
out
else and who isn't.
And yeah. It was actually a very powerful moment, because it was a big room, and you have you know, all of the who's who in yoga studies, and even and more. There was a real, as we said at the top of the podcast, it was a real coming together of the field.
It was. And it turns out we were all yoga practitioners as well. What a shock!
But I wasn't surprised by that.
No,
because I think if you're in this field, you kind of have a sense of that that. You know, to have the motivation and passion to go through the suffering and trials and tribulations, to sacrifice any sense of financial or monetary reward or sense of a career, to devote everything you have to make all your family and loved ones to want to do a PhD on yoga, and then to have not had any sense of practice or positive transformative effect of that again, to go back to the dance or the music culture, that would be a bit odd.
That would be really strange.
I know it happens now. Maybe even more now, because the field is becoming more successful, and I think people from allied fields are wanting to dip their toes into yoga studies.
They are. So that's you can different. Tell though, can't you?
You can. definitely you can tell.
What's also interesting to me, okay, so a fun game that I like to play, and I'm not going to give any names, is trying to figure out what traditions people have studied.
Yeah, like what their personal background is.
Yeah. You know when they were. You can usually tell if they're, well, there's, you know, Ashtanga people or Ayanga people or Shivananda people. You can figure it out.
For sure. Or Siddha yoga. There's a huge, you know, especially in the world of Tantra and in Indology, there's a huge
they're all Siddha yoga people.
History of Siddha yogis turned academics. But so that's there. And in fact, I haven't read it yet, but there is, I think Mark Singleton and Borian Larios have that new chapter in the Rutledge Handbook. I've got it on my desk, actually, but I have to read that.
Yeah.
And hopefully I want to get Borian on here, actually, to talk about it.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, Mark Singleton's another one that most people don't know. He's I hear, an extremely competent yoga teacher.
Yep. Yeah, he comes from an Iyengar background.
Yeah. So it is that interesting thing, because it's interesting that on the one hand, so we get two kinds of pushback as yoga scholars from the field, and one is from you know, practitioners. One is that we're mere academics who know nothing about yoga, and the other is that we're trying to define what yoga is. And I think in a weird way, they're both approaching the same fact, which is that we don't want to be telling other people what yoga is, so therefore we don't talk about our personal connections to yoga.
Right. I think we're also very much trained and ingrained in religious studies, especially because of the complexities of this issue within the history of the discipline, to not wear those cards on your sleeve, as it were.
Yes. I stepped out of my lane by doing that. I thought I'm quite often the person who points out the elephant in the room. And
I'm all for it. And in fact, I hope this podcast space can be, you know, even just in telling, I'm asking scholars who are coming on to tell your story, tell your personal background
absolutely.
With yoga. And that's an open invitation to go where you want with that. I'm not drilling on people, who's your guru and what tradition did you come from, you know? And that's very personal, but I'm trying to open that up a little bit, because it's typically not a conversation scholars are comfortable having, and yet it's so formative in shaping who they are as people, as well as their research topics and interests that animate and power their lives and careers. So
And it has deep and personal relevance. I'm not formally connected to the Satchinanda lineage, but I am through teachers of mine, and I'm a Yoga Nidra teacher. And when the revelations broke, it really started to break about Satchinanda, I couldn't practice Yoga Nidra for 3 weeks.
Mm.
I couldn't do it.
Because the way you had been teaching it was very much tied to these guru figures who had committed abuse.
Yes, and because of my dear friend Matthew Remsky, who wrote in an article, I think I'm going to paraphrase and I'm going to get it slightly wrong, but he said something like, these practices are aimed at deep psycho-spiritual transformation. It would be useful to know if they are the fabrications of rapists.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and I couldn't do Shavasana for about 3 weeks. Yeah, I couldn't do Yoga Nidra. I couldn't lie on my yoga mat after that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got better. But yeah, this is deep and it's personal.
Right.
Those moments of transformation. So reconciling that and my own history and my own issues around that and yet trying to be fair to communities of people who have found incredible transformation and beauty within that same practice. These are not easy roads to walk, I think.
And then this then leads to the kind of immediate responses then, as you said earlier, separate the teaching from the teacher, which is, on the one hand, I don't know, easier said than done. On the other, when it comes to a lot of these practices, it really is the case when we look at history that they do not own those ideas or practices. They've put their own unique spins on them.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I do think that in some cases there is a natural way to do so, to kind of go back to the roots or source of a particular practice or method in certain cases. But it's not without problems.
No. But there are, I think, communities produce knowledge. If we go back to kind of Anusara, there were all sorts of interesting rumors that floated around. These are rumors, by the way. I can't kind of evidence any of this, but there were rumors that John's first wife wrote the teacher training manual and her name had just been excised from history. There's the incredible contribution that Doug Keller made to the development of Anusara that was never recognized. He was virtually excommunicated from it. So there are all these people that are involved in producing knowledge, even within these fairly kind of hierarchical systems. But of course, all of the benefit somehow gets transferred to the person at the head. So that's one of the things I would be asking people who are going through these going through abuse revelations is it possible that the benefit and the joy that you found did not come from this flawed figure, this kind of abusive figure, even in front of you? Did you kind of misattribute the source of your transformation in those spaces?
Yeah, big questions and no easy answers at all. I think we could go on for much longer, but I want to respect your time. I know it's getting late in the evening there.
It is.
But to kind of wrap things up, if somebody is picking up your book, I guess there's different types of audiences, right? Whether they're a yoga teacher practitioner or a scholar. But, what is kind of the big takeaway that you hope somebody will have from reading this book? I guess another way to ask that is kind of what is, kind of your main argument, if you can sum that up in a neat little nutshell.
I think like the best scholarship, what I really want to leave people with is a series of questions. To reflect on, I've attempted to make some things visible that maybe weren't visible before. And they're not just structures, but also processes. you know, like I said, kind of the different ways in which we navigate authority, the ways in which we kind of balance external authority and internal authority and those kinds of things. So what I really want people to be left with is a sense of, okay, but how do I answer those questions? How does it work for me? And how does it work in my life? And what relevance does this have to me? And if the answer is absolutely zero, I'm absolutely fine with that. I just want us maybe to start asking those questions. As a result, I don't think it's a book that gives answers. And I think as a result, it fits within a scholarly tradition, but not necessarily within a yoga book tradition. And I think that a lot of mainstream yoga books are written with answers. They're written as kind of like, here is a way that you can do things that's going to work. They're kind of quite reassuring and very single voice. And this is not the book that's going to give you answers. It's going to give you questions. And if that's comfortable to sit with, then hopefully it will be of use to a much wider number of people as a result.
Great. Well, congratulations on the book. As somebody who is currently dissertating, I know
how's it going?
You know what? Actually, as of right now, I can say progress is being made. I just submitted two Yay. Chapter drafts last week. So that was kind of an exciting milestone. But it's been grueling. Not going to lie. Yeah. For me, the writing process is very challenging. So I have the utmost respect for all of you who are not only producing dissertations, but turning those dissertations into books that are clearly written, arguments well laid out. I commend you. And for our listeners, especially if you're a yoga teacher, I think there's a lot of really important things to learn, questions that are being raised, and really worth taking a look at. So thanks so much, Theo, for your time today and walking us through all that. Where can our listeners find the book, learn more about you, or find you online?
Well, the really easy thing is my sweet husband has made just a one-page website at postlineage.yoga. The idea is that we can throw on there not all links to different places you can buy the book, and because of course I'm not in control of that, and also that we can throw on things like this podcast when it comes out. We can throw in links to that as well, so that there are other ways for people to access this information. So it's all in one place and nice and easy, and all I have to do is say to people, postlineage.yoga. If you're interested in anything to do with the book, it will probably be on there. I have a website of my own, which is about at least 5 years out of date, but it's, you know, it has a blog occasionally that people seem to like to read. But more usefully, perhaps, to my knowledge, I'm the only Theo Wildcroft on the planet. So you can find me on kind of all the usual channels that we love to hate and hate to love, kind of Twitter and Instagram and Facebook and so on. Some of them are slightly more locked down than others, because I do sometimes attract controversy, and I like to keep that off my timeline.
Well, shout out to your husband, Phil, because he's done created a beautiful website for postlineage.yoga here. And he also helped out with some tech issues with the sound before we recorded here. So shout out to Phil.
He is. Phil's a little older than me. He's kind of an IT professional. His mission is to get to a point where he can be my housewife. I don't know if I'll ever get to the point of earning enough money for him to do that, but he's pushing for that. He thinks that I enjoy it. He said that he thinks I enjoy my work more than he does. He's quite happy.
Well, in our house, we're all about giving the academic husbands and academic wives shout outs and lots of credit for all the support. So,
absolutely.
All right, Theo. Well, thanks again so much for your time. I look forward to being in touch, and who knows, maybe even seeing you in Krakow.
That would be so nice.
Post-COVID world, fingers crossed.
All right, let's set that intention.
All right, take care. Thanks for listening to the Yogic Studies podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or sharing this episode with someone else. Thanks so much, everyone. Until next time, please take care.